From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
Speaking to us from a bunker in Florida. And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Hey, Bob, we meet again.
We do indeed. I apologize for the tinniness of what follows, but the microphone I have is the microphone I have.
What are you, the Donald Rumsfeld of radio announcers?
That's correct.
Well, just to save the listeners' ears for a while, I will read this intro into you.
Okay.
President Obama's first tour of Asia was heavily covered by the U.S. press.
President Obama tending to one of America's most complicated and critical relationships, China.
Commentators made sure to note the difficulties he faced.
President Obama arrived in Shanghai in a driving rain. The challenges here, though, began before his feet even touched the tarmac.
And when the president touched down at home Thursday, he was welcomed by pundits with a verdict on his trip. The consensus? They thought he'd showed an inveterate lack of vertebra.
There is a real danger here that the Chinese will have concluded from this that the United States is a power on the wane and a president who is cautious and timid, and we can pretty much have our way.
The Atlantic's James Fallows, who has reported both from China and worked within a presidential administration, joins us to talk about the president's trip and the media coverage it engendered. Bob, take it from here.
I've been reading about the president's trip to China in the New York Times and the Washington Post in particular, and had come to discover that it was a complete fiasco. He let us down as a spokesman for American values and human rights and as a spokesman for a floating Chinese currency to improve the trade imbalance between our two countries. Did he do anything right?
You know, compared to any rational expectations of what this trip could have accomplished, President Obama did pretty well. I think the tone of the U.S. coverage says more about sort of embedded narratives in the U.S. press mindset than it does anything that happened or didn't happen in Tokyo or Beijing or Shanghai.
What sort of narratives?
One of them is an idea that China is now our paymaster. Therefore, American presidents must act as petitioners. And I think that China has much less leverage than that image would imply, and we're much more mutually at each other's mercy than is usually suggested. And also, one assumption from this tone is that if we weren't in debt to the Chinese, Obama would have gone there and have pounded his fist on the table and say, we really disapprove your policy in Tibet. We really want people to be let out of jails. Number one, that's not how Barack Obama is ever, anywhere, in any circumstance. And number two, I think nobody who has ever dealt with the Chinese leadership thinks that is a way you accomplish things, whether it's on currency values or environmental cooperation or anything else.
Now, let's go to the text, because the pieces I'm actually referring to are an editorial in the New York Times, a piece by Paul Krugman, the economics columnist with a somewhat broader portfolio than that, and Dana Milbank of the Washington Post. And they all kind of acknowledge that the president did this, this, and this, for example, raise the issue of Tibet, raise the issue of human rights, raise the issue of the currency imbalance. But there was always a but. He should have done more. Is that a fair analysis that the president should have been more assertive?
I guess it's fair on a compared to what basis. I think if you apply the metric of any American president will behave more or less in his own nature and his own political style when he's traveling around the world, then you have a pretty realistic projection of how they will be. When Bill Clinton was in China in his first visit after Tiananmen Square in the late 1990s, he held a kind of rollicking town meeting, which was like the other town meetings Bill Clinton has held.
Clinton famously criticized the Chinese for Tiananmen Square. And that is one of the points made by the various editorialists saying, if President Clinton could be so bold, why couldn't President Obama?
While standing next to Hu Jintao in Beijing, he said, we believe you should meet with the Dalai Lama, which is at the moment a much more sensitive issue in China than Tiananmen is. In his appearance in Shanghai, when asked about the Great Firewall, when asked about freedom of expression, Barack Obama made the points, I think, about as well as you could expect a visiting American statesman to make. Did he do a perfect job? Of course not. I'm mainly reacting against the tone that this was a disaster, a failure, a humiliation. If you want to think of that, remember the first George Bush vomiting on the Japanese prime minister back in 1991. Now, that's a humiliation.
Okay, that was a faux pas. So to what do you attribute the kind of reflexive criticism of a president who is acknowledged to have done some of what these commentators were looking for, but not quite enough.
I think, number one, if you have a traveling political press corps, which is mainly concerned with the way the president is doing on his home terrain, if they think he is being weak, if they think he's losing ground, if they think he's not standing up for himself, it's natural to see those things in a foreign setting, too. I think also there is the background sense that China has gotten stronger and more dominant over the United States than, in my view, it really is. And if that's what you're thinking, if you think that anything the president doesn't say must be because he needs that next $1 billion in Chinese money, then you make that connection, whereas I think there are other explanations of what he did and did not say.
All right, Jim. Well, as always, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
James Fallows is a correspondent for The Atlantic. He spends a whole lot of time in China, but is speaking to us this week from Washington, D.C. From the outside, the Chinese media appear to be a monolith controlled with an implacable hand by the state. And mostly, that's true. Touch on sensitive subjects pertaining to the party or the state, and you will suffer consequences. But there are a few notable exceptions, or at least there were a few. When On the Media went to China last year, Brooke visited Caixin Magazine, a biweekly financial and business publication that over a 10-year period had built a reputation for printing real investigative reporting. We wanted to know how it managed that difficult feat, and one editor explained that it took agility, connections, and sometimes impenetrable prose. Most of all, it took a keen sense of which hotspots were simply too hot.
We all know that there's a line in China and it's electrified. If you touch it, you're dead. Other media know this, so they draw their own line. They create a safety zone of, say, 50 meters, and they don't get closer than that. But Caixin is different. It gets closer.
Has Caixin already reached the line and survived? We're not sure where that line is, so I can't say.
That is, until a few weeks ago, when Caixin's founding editor and guiding light, Hu Shili, abruptly resigned after disagreeing with Caixin's publishers over money matters and censorship. Dozens of the magazine's top editors left with her, signaling the apparent end of Caixin and the example it had set. Jeremy Goldcorn is the founder and editor of DanWei.org, a website devoted to analyzing Chinese media. He says that while there are a few other publications brave enough to broach controversial subjects, none is so carefully read by Chinese power brokers and the outside world.
It has been one of the very few publications that has been willing to tackle subjects that are considered sensitive here. So it's done articles about, for example, SARS, when the government was denying that SARS was a problem in China in 2003. They've also done stories about corruption and various malfeasances of big government bodies in China.
How has it been able to stay sort of out of the way of the censors?
There are a few factors. They haven't really covered rule of law or the interaction between citizens and the government. They've been focused on business. Also, the company that owned the magazine, SEEC, is quite a well-connected company. Wang Boming, chairman of the company, is quite tightly involved with the bodies that regulate the Chinese financial markets. And this has also given them a certain amount of protection. The thing is that most of their muckraking stories are concealed behind 8 pages of verbiage that is very difficult to read. And this is something that they've always said is one of the reasons why they haven't been censored. They may have been able to print something that nobody else would dare to print, but it's very difficult to actually get to the juicy stuff.
Now, the news this week is the resignation of the magazine's editor, Hu Shili, a major figure in Chinese journalism.
And in fact, without her, it's very difficult to conceive of Caixin as having any integrity at all. She's one of the very few Chinese editors who's been willing to commit herself in public and in print to principles of journalism that uphold the truth above business interests. The talk in the Chinese media scene and on the Chinese internet is that she has been offered a tenured position at Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, as the dean of the journalism department there.
And does that mean she will have been co-opted, or does it mean that she's just
landed on her feet.
If she becomes a full-time teacher and does not go back into the publishing business and the media business, it doesn't mean she's been co-opted. It means she's been sidelined.
Now, all of this commotion is the result of protests from Hu and many of her colleagues about how the money is apportioned. She wanted more money for editorial and more authority over how the money was spent. Is it ultimately a press freedom issue, or is something just more mundane afoot?
In the Chinese media business, it's very rarely only one thing going on at one time. On the one hand, the editorial staff at Caijing felt that the value that they were contributing was being turned into cash from advertising, which was being spent on other publications or other business ends, aside from making this magazine better. That, I think, is certainly a factor. In the Chinese media circles, there's been gossip for already 2 months now that the propaganda department, which is now called the publicity department, actually, has been squeezing SEEC, her publisher, to get rid of her because she's too controversial.
How important is this episode to the progress and openness and press freedom? Is this a tempest in a teapot, or is it something quite serious?
In some ways, it's a tempest in a teapot because it's very much business as usual. In the Chinese media, it's very rare for any person or any institution to be able to sustain a groundbreaking media company. If you take risks and you want to continue to be profitable, you often end up in trouble. And Caijing is just the latest example of many, 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 many. But it is very, very sad that things have come to this, because Caijing definitely was some kind of beacon in a country that really lacks principled journalism.
Well, Jeremy, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeremy Goldkorn is the founder and editor-in-chief of Donwei.org, a website devoted to the Chinese media.
Coming up, a new gloss on rose-colored glasses, specs that augment reality.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On his first full day in office, President Barack Obama wrote a memo to department heads instructing them to respond to Freedom of Information Act requests promptly and in a spirit of cooperation. Disclosure, Obama wrote, should be timely. And soon after, the CIA finally released material that had been requested by the non-governmental, non-profit National Security Archive 20 years ago. The National Security Archive, which files up to 2,000 record requests a year, reported this month that the delayed release shows exactly what's wrong with FOIA. Yvette Chin, the archive's FOIA coordinator, says the documents themselves are mostly old news, in part because Congress had investigated Iran-Contra long ago. Those records focus on Manachar Gabanafar, an important figure in the Reagan-era Iran-Contra affair.
He's an Iranian-born businessman who was ultimately integral in transferring arms during the Iran-Contra affair. He also later provided intelligence. The National Security Archive, my organization, has been filing FOIAs for the last 25 years, and it actually got its start looking for documents about the Iran-Contra affair. So this is very much an old one for us.
So let me see if I've got this right. The National Security Archive, someone there opens the mail one day, and here is the response to a FOIA request sent 20 years ago? Is that what happened?
Absolutely. And I wish I could say that that was unusual, but it happens all the time.
Were you able to figure out what happened in the intervening two decades?
We received three pieces of correspondence from the CIA. One of them was soon after we had filed the request to actually acknowledge the receipt of that request. But then we received two letters, one in 1992 and one in 2003. And in both cases, the CIA did not seem terribly interested in the processing of the request, but rather looking for clarification about how they should levy fees on us in order to process the request.
Do I understand correctly that the CIA has released a document to you with more material blacked out than was blacked out in the same document that has been a matter of public record since 1987?
That's correct. When we received a new version, there were more redactions to it. This is kind of an ongoing problem. The United States government often reclassifies material that is already available in the public domain. In a lot of ways, it's a lot like putting toothpaste back into the tube.
Was there anything in the ultimate response from the CIA that was particularly revealing about Gabanafar's role or anything else that happened in those days?
Some of it had already been in the public domain for a fair amount of time. Some of the material was actually released as a result of Congress's investigation into the affair. But really, there weren't any smoking guns in this particular release. But on the other hand, there's also an unknown quantity of material that the CIA continues to withhold.
So maybe there's all sorts of revealing, incriminating detail in there that you may never see.
Exactly. And that's a real problem because we don't even know how much is being withheld in this case.
Isn't the law fairly explicit about timeliness, that the agency is expected to respond quickly and if it is unable to fulfill the request, to explain why?
At the moment, an agency is supposed to respond to a request within 20 days, not just acknowledge the receipt of the request, but actually fulfill the request. Now, in some ways, those expectations might be a little high. However, waiting 20 years is very different from waiting 20 days.
There was nothing in that letter that said, oh, sorry, this slipped between the cracks.
There was one line that basically thanked us for our patience for, I believe the letter says, an extraordinary length of time.
Is it possible to work the refs? In other words, to complain about this call so that you'll get the break on the next one?
Well, we certainly wouldn't want to use this example to get favor, but I think it's really important to shed light on the fact that there's a systemic problem with FOIA processing, and this is just one example.
Now, you guys are constantly filing such requests. I wonder if you've noticed any change in the Obama administration compared to its immediate predecessor.
We certainly see changes in the horizon that we view positively. But in terms of the day-to-day processing and the day-to-day operations, I don't see too much change. In my position at the National Security Archive as FOIA coordinator, I can look for patterns in how agencies behave. I'm seeing a little bit more in terms of customer service, checking in on requests, but generally speaking, in terms of massive releases of information, I'm not quite seeing that yet.
Yvette, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yvette Chin is the FOIA coordinator for the nonprofit National Security Archive.
The December issue of Esquire features a familiar face on the cover, Robert Downey Jr. It also features a less familiar technology, augmented reality, or AR. Hold up the Esquire cover to a webcam and a video version of the actor pops out onto your computer screen.
Booyah! In your face!
We are presently entwined in an AR environment. Easily the most remarkable way to experience a magazine.
Tilt the magazine and the digital Downey reacts. Some inside pages feature similar stunts. Augmented reality officially hit the iPhone in August. There were apps that utilize its GPS and camera capabilities to overlay information, say restaurant reviews, onto your nearby surroundings. They can help you locate everything from historic landmarks to houses for sale, even people. Plus, there are AR action figures, children's books, baseball cards, business cards. In the movie Minority Report, Tom Cruise uses a version of augmented reality to solve murders before they happen. Standing in front of a large semi-transparent screen, Cruise, wearing sensory-equipped gloves, waves his arms around to push and pull images.
Time horizon, 12 minutes.
All right, what he's doing now, we call scrubbing the image, looking for clues as to where the murder's going to happen.
Near the capital?
Georgetown.
The film is set in 2054. Now, 45 years prior, a Minority Report-inspired device is already being developed at MIT. The device combines a smartphone, a camera, and a mini projector to access and project the virtual world onto the physical one. But in a recent commentary for Atlantic magazine, futurist Jaime Casio says it won't be too long before we'll all have some kind of AR.
Looking forward, it's very likely that we will see this kind of technology integrated into something a bit more convenient to look through, that is, a pair of glasses. There's a science fiction story by Werner Vinge where people have augmented reality technology integrated onto contact lenses. And in fact, there are people working on that very technology right now.
In your piece for The Atlantic, you said that spam will inevitably trickle into the commercial augmented reality world. I guess we can't avoid it, can we?
Fortunately, part of the power of the digital world is that it's given us new tools to be able to filter out the ads. We will also be developing the tools to filter what we see in reality.
You mean not just block out spam that goes into your device or your glasses, but to block out actual billboards on the roadway?
As this technology develops, it will include the ability to identify what it sees through its camera. And what that will include, of course, is the ability to identify posters and billboards and book covers and whatever else kind of visual cues around the environment. And if you have that ability, well, then it's just one small step to the capacity to block out the things that you don't want to see.
And from there, we get to what seems to me the really dark side of this technology. If it can recognize a billboard, it can recognize a face, which could increase our ability to filter out everything from the world that we don't like.
As I began to think about the consequences of this new technology, it struck me that these same kinds of patterns that we've been seeing in our online lives already, that is, patterns around spam and spam blocking, and patterns around the use of these technologies for, in some cases, political divisions, it seemed obvious to me that these would come together in a way that would actually allow people to block out political opponents, people with whom they disagree. They just can remove them from their view.
In other words, you're walking down the street and you see somebody who supports a position you don't like, and you've adjusted your augmented reality glasses so that a little black dot covers up their face?
Right. You don't want to make them invisible, which eventually you might be able to have technology that could do that because you don't want to run into them, of course. But you want to have some way of identifying this is someone that I don't want to talk to, someone whose political or social positions I find abhorrent, and I don't want to accidentally run into them and engage them in conversation. I don't want to make it sound like it's only this kind of scary future. But as with every technology we develop, there are inevitably negative, surprising consequences that emerge alongside the, broad social benefits.
And you anticipate some, nothing short of moral panic over this technology.
You'll get stories highlighting the social conflict aspects, and you will have people who are railing in front of Congress about, we need to stop this. We'll have a parents' augmented reality research group springing up, wanting to have mandatory filters on any kind of augmented reality tool aimed at children.
When do you anticipate that this kind of augmented reality technology will be sufficiently entrenched to engender that kind of moral panic?
Probably when it is easy to use surreptitiously. Right now, if I hold up my iPhone with an AR program on it, it's pretty obvious what I'm doing. But if I have an augmented reality system embedded in my sunglasses, no one would be able to tell just at a glance that I'm actually scanning my environment and being able to identify people and places and things.
You're carrying a concealed weapon.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, Jamais.
Thank you very much.
Jamais Cassio is a senior fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technology. So as we heard, the internet helps us stay connected near and far and transmit our views endlessly across time and space. So why, then, is there such a widespread perception that our computers cut us off? Maybe it's because we're physically isolated when we use the web. Or maybe it's because of a 2006 study that tried to gauge social isolation in America. That study asked the same questions as a study 20 years earlier and found that, sure enough, we have grown more isolated. Lee Rainey of the Pew Internet and American Life Project says that the 2006 study had a huge impact on social scientists concerned about isolation. So Pew set out to test, or rather retest, the assertion that people are increasingly isolated, and then re-examine the assumed connection between isolation and use of the internet. The old survey measured how many confidants people had, and Rainey said that if you had no one to confide in, you were considered socially isolated.
They found that between 1985 and 2004, that the level of social isolation in America had almost tripled. The second thing they found was that even among those who did have confidants that they could discuss important matters with, they had fewer confidants than before.
And basically, this 2006 study blamed this increasing isolation on the presence of the internet in people's homes.
It was a pretty logical suspect to look at, because the rise of the internet and the rise of mobile phones in people's lives directly coincided with this major social change, the shrinkage of networks and the growth of isolation. But it was a guess. There was no direct evidence. So we asked people in our phone survey, who are the people with whom you discuss important matters in your life? And then we, of course, asked about their technology use, and we figured out who was an internet user and who was a broadband user, and we asked about some of the things that they did online. Did they belong to social networking sites? Did they use instant messaging? Did they share pictures online? And what we found was that the people who are internet users and the people who are cell phone users have bigger networks than others. They have more diverse networks than others, and it very much challenges the notion that technology is the cause of this major social change.
But what specifically did you find along those lines?
We found that there was no increase in social isolation between 1985 and our survey in the summer of 2008. So we challenged the findings that total isolation had tripled in the 20-year span. We did find that networks had shrunk.
And by networks, we mean circle of friends.
Yes. In 1985, the average American reported three people in that core social network. In 2008, when we gathered our data, they reported about two people in that core social network. But we also then said, well, maybe the internet's the cause of this shrinkage of social networks, but we found the exact opposite. Internet users and cell phone users have bigger and more diverse networks.
One of the things you found that I found particularly surprising was that, for instance, frequent internet users and those who maintain a blog are much more likely to confide in someone who is of another race, and that those who share photos online are more likely to report that they discuss important matters with someone who is a member of another political party.
Yes, there are interesting sort of suspicions about why that's so. When you participate in social networking sites, you're learning more about people when they are sharing stuff like their pictures or their blog posts or their social network wall posts and stuff like that. So they're learning that, oh, my buddy isn't a Republican like I thought he was. He turns out to be a Democrat. Or, oh, this part of his spiritual life is very different from what I thought it used to be. And so we're learning more about the diversity of our friends in ways that our parents couldn't have learned.
We often think of the internet as this, you know, global communications network, but your study found that the internet is actually used to communicate locally just as much as over long distance.
There is the suspicion that internet use and cell phone use is removing people from local life, from their neighborhoods, from the voluntary associations in their communities, and from the public spaces like parks and restaurants and bars in their communities. And so we asked about that, and it turns out that internet users are no more likely to be removed from their communities than anyone else. In fact, they're just as likely to be as deeply involved.
But, Lee, there was one finding that does seem to go against this trend. It seems that internet users don't really rely on their neighbors for help. In fact, they are 40% less likely to rely on neighbors for help in caring for themselves or a family member, and are 26% less likely to rely on their neighbors for help with small services like repairs and lending tools. Do you think that's just because they have access to an internet full of help?
I think that's partly the story, but it also might be the case that internet users as a class of people just don't need that level of help compared to other folks. That, you know, they're more likely to be employed, they're more likely to have higher incomes, they're more likely to have other sources of support that are available to them. But the second side of that equation definitely does hold up. Internet users and cell phone users are just as likely as everyone else to be contributors to their neighbors, to offer social support to the people in their communities that need it. It might be that they need less help, but they are certainly willing and able to offer as much help as everybody else to their local community.
So you're saying internet users are just basically more evolved.
They can be. Yes, that's exactly right. The fact of the matter is, in many cases, the internet allows people just to be more engaged and more active in their networks because they can reach out to more people more quickly than people who don't use it.
It's almost axiomatic that the internet is hazardous to your health. Is this a rebuke to that conventional wisdom?
For centuries, when new technologies come on the scene, there's almost an instinctive human reaction, particularly among those who are challenged by the new technology, to blame the technology for any social ill that happens to arise at the same time. Something has gone on with our social networks in the past 20 years. Our data matched the data that the previous researchers had collected, showing the networks are shrinking. And so now we're inviting other social scientists and researchers like ourselves to go out and find the real culprit and not just think that the internet lies behind it just because the internet was being adopted at the same time this harmful social trend was emerging.
Lee, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Lee Rainey is the director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project.
Coming up, the next national census is in 2010. Here's how not to answer when they come to your door.
How long have you lived at this address?
Oh, man, there you go with the numbers again.
Just take your time.
Well, what do most people say?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John Dee and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a clarification. Back in September, we spoke with David Goodman, who wrote in Mother Jones magazine about the U.S. military's use of video games like Halo 3 for recruitment.
Last week, we were contacted by a representative from Microsoft, which manufactures the Xbox 360 and publishes Halo 3. Microsoft took issue with a few of Goodman's assertions and wrote, "The military was not the primary underwriter of Halo 3. In fact, Microsoft was the primary underwriter and Bungie was the developer. The Army didn't provide any graphics in any way throughout the game. While there are Army advertisements on the Xbox 360 dashboard, there are no advertisements for the Army, no links or anything throughout the game of Halo 3 itself. And there are parental controls on Xbox 360 consoles that parents can use to prevent their kids from seeing any advertisements, including the Army-related ones, from the dashboard."
We asked David Goodman for his response, and this is what he wrote to us. Quote, "The boundaries that Microsoft claims exist between it and the Army are not perceived by players of Xbox 360 games such as Halo 3, and that is intentional. The U.S. Army invested about $1.3 million to be the main partner and underwriter for the blockbuster Halo 3 franchise, and the seamless integration of sponsor and product has been carefully orchestrated. The Army was the exclusive sponsor of Microsoft's launch of Halo 3, which included the game being delivered to stores by helmeted soldiers in Humvees. The Army has also been the exclusive sponsor of Halo 3 Xbox Live tournaments online. The Army's ad agency boasted that, quote, the Army creative for this sponsorship was the first of its kind, seamlessly merging real Army images and videos with Halo images and videos. As for blocking this content for underage users, perhaps some parents of teenage boys would be willing to describe how successful they've been when trying to impose these restrictions on their kids. In short, Microsoft created the Halo 3 game, then eagerly helped the Army to deploy it."
Keep those corrections, criticisms, and gratuitous flattery coming in. You can comment at onthemedia.org or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org.
In October, Republican Senator David Vitter of Louisiana proposed adding a question to the upcoming 2010 census, asking residents whether or not they are citizens. Here he is on the floor of the Senate.
"I believe that when we use the census for congressional redistricting for determining how many U.S. House seats each state gets, we should count citizens but we should not count in that context non-citizens, including illegal aliens.
Vitter's amendment would have required the U.S. Census Bureau to effectively change the forms, which had already been printed. So the Senate voted it down 60-39 along party lines. This isn't the first time controversy has erupted over the decennial ritual of tallying our nation's population. In fact, around the time of the very first census in 1790, George Washington wrote a letter to the statesman Governor Morris expressing concern that, quote,
"The real number will greatly exceed the official return because, from religious scruples, some would not give in their lists. From an apprehension that it was intended as the foundation of a tax, others concealed or diminished theirs. And from the indolence of the mass and want of activity in many of the deputy enumerators, numbers are omitted."
Devera Cohn is a former Washington Post reporter who has covered the census for many years. She says that controversy followed the count all through the 20th century.
The Roosevelt administration was very interested in finding out more information about the living conditions of Americans. So they added a good many questions on finances, for example, asking Americans their income. They asked many questions about housing conditions, including plumbing in individual homes. All of it was intended to bolster the role of government in trying to solve social problems, but there were some people who were not pleased. In fact, an excerpt from an April 1940 New Yorker sketch, I don't know whether this is true or not, but it said, "A lady who lives in a hotel received the census man cordially and answered all the questions. After asking, 'Have you a bathtub?' the enumerator in the same official tone asked, 'Have you a pair of manicure scissors?' The lady said yes, and waited for the next question. 'Well, could I borrow them?' he asked. 'There's a hangnail been driving me nuts all day.'"
Now, the privacy issue continued to build. In 1960, an editor at the National Review was fined $100 for not filling out the form.
One editor declared he wasn't going to fill out his form. He declared war on what he called snoopdom. Of course, the National Review is on the conservative side, and they've long been opposed to turning in any more than just the basic information, which would be number of people in any given household.
The 1990 census is the first one that you personally covered as a reporter for the Washington Post. There was the so-called long form, which got longer, and many in the media declared this census, the 1990 census, to be a kind of failure, right?
That's right. It was a public relations nightmare in 1990 because the census's own research showed that it hadn't made a dent in what's called the undercount. That is, we know the census doesn't count everybody, but they keep hoping that the size of that undercount will shrink. Well, it didn't shrink in 1990, and that was widely reported. There were stories, for example, in USA Today about how some of these upscale gated communities were not allowing census takers to come in and distribute the forms. Barbara Walters saying that she felt that it was too tough to fill out her form, so she wasn't going to fill it out. After the count numbers came out, there was a front page photograph in the New York Times showing an apartment building in Queens where people said that they had not been included in the census. It turned out later that they had been counted, but they were listed on the wrong block. So all of these mishaps, I guess, led to a kind of a black eye for the 1990 census.
And so what's going to households in 2010 is something that they're billing as 10 questions in 10 minutes.
10 questions, 10 minutes. It's essentially the short form with basic demographics such as age, race, and if there's more than one person in the household, how those people are related to each other. But the Census Bureau is still struggling with how to respond to this new media environment. They're putting themselves out there on social media and they're blogging and so forth, but it remains to be seen whether, especially in the heated up census environment that'll really start to accelerate starting next year, whether they'll be able to keep up with the incoming fire.
Devera, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Devera Cohn is a senior writer at the Pew Research Center. And now, briefly, a census taker's nightmare, courtesy of Tim Meadows, Christopher Walken, and Saturday Night Live.
Hi.
Yes, Mr. Leonard, I'm with the U.S. Census Bureau. How many people live in this residence?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. I'm bad with numbers. Maybe 80.
80 people live in this apartment?
Seems high. doesn't it? Not 80. How about 4?
The narrative of the crumbling newspaper industry has been well documented in, well, newspapers, not to mention this show, but now the story of a shredding is playing on stage.
You want to know what my basic skill set is? We can go into a room full of powerful people and start asking questions. Annoying questions. Follow-up questions to the annoying questions.
That's a scene from a new play about the life and death of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer called It's Not in the PI, a Living Newspaper About a Dying Newspaper. The paper, founded in 1863, printed its final edition in March, shuttered by the Hearst Corporation. It left Seattle a one-newspaper town and many journalists jobless. Tom Paulson is one of them, a former science writer. He was with the PI for 22 years, and he says the genesis of the play was born the same way PI reporters hatched many of their best ideas.
Beer, yes. It was the genesis came from beer, like most great ideas in the world. Paul Mullen, who's one of Seattle's top playwrights, is a friend of mine, and we were having beer. I was complaining about losing my job and the demise of print journalism and so forth. Paul basically said that he's a playwright, and the fact that I'm complaining about this is ridiculous because he's so much more unappreciated. And we argued about who was more unappreciated, journalists or playwrights. And then with a few more beers, decided that, you know, this actually would make a good play. Paul wanted to make the construction of the play like putting together a newspaper. He contacted other playwrights in Seattle, five others, and I told them to go out and talk to some of my colleagues. When they talked to a police reporter, they talked to business people, people who work in the building and aren't reporters or part of the PI. And so they got this great collage of different scenes from the newspaper and views of the newspaper.
But why produce the play? Was it some sort of catharsis?
When the PI stopped printing last spring, there were a lot of very serious articles and woe is me kind of stuff and celebrations of our history and, you know, kind of the typical thing you see when an institution goes away. And what was missing was this irreverent description of the reality there and the ignoble aspects of journalism and the goofiness of the PI. And I just thought I really would like to see that somewhere represented.
One of the sections takes place in the newsroom. It's a pretty hilarious argument over the interns and who's going to prey on them.
It's the most glorious time of the year.
What is he talking about?
Interns!
Oh!
That's right. A fresh, young, nubile crop of innocent, yes, eager interns come skipping into our office today. Today, I wore my blue shirt. It brings out my eyes.
Absolutely. Stay the away from my interns. I'm not joking.
Did you take a little license there?
The whole idea was all of these scenes are going to be based on reality. And so I think there's some fact there. There's some license there.
One of my favorite scenes is this reporter calling a politician and they are narrating their subtext.
Then direct question.
Insincere confusion about the point of the question.
Restatement of question.
Off-topic comment.
Same question.
Deep rumination and troubled contemplation.
Same question.
Complicated reasons why the question itself can't be addressed as posed.
Carefully rephrased question.
Counter question about the future of the PI with the suggestion that the Pacific Northwest would be better off without so many questions.
I laugh out loud every time I watch them do it.
What do you think the public gets out of a scene like that?
Well, I think they understand the tug of war between the media and people in power, in this case, a city councilman, and also what's both fun and painful about it, because the scene starts with the reporter. I'm identifying with her, of course, and she's having fun with this guy squirming and trying to convince her not to do the story. But as the scene progresses, I actually become more uncomfortable because it's clear that she is continuing to do this story even after he's been booted out of office and she's going to do something based on a personal problem that he's having. And he's arguing, why am I even news? Why don't you just leave me alone?
In a friendly way, I'd like to suggest you move on to something else. Certainly you have more important stories to pursue.
Well, Tim, I'd like the pitch of my voice to rise slightly in order to indicate that you've not only not put me off the story, you've actually increased my interest.
Then I'd like my voice to register disappointment that you are being so unreasonable.
I hear that. And can you hear the barely disguised pleasure with which I register your change in tone?
So it kind of cuts both ways, and I think both the public, who sometimes thinks the media digs too deep or is too invasive, are going to identify with maybe the end of the scene.
Which leads us to a point that you've made, which is that reporters aren't necessarily noble people. They're often not likable people. In fact, you say that reporters often don't like each other, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's probably an occupational hazard. I loved working at the PI. I really enjoyed being around most of my colleagues, but we're pushy, nosy, all those kind of things.
What was it like watching the rehearsal, seeing the PI newsroom be resurrected at least for a few weeks?
There's scenes in there that are going to make people upset. And then the scenes portraying myself made me very uncomfortable. It's very weird watching somebody else pretend to be you.
How long did you work there prior to being laid off?
26 years.
Wow, impressive. So during that time, how did you contribute to the PI's bottom line?
I have no clue how I contributed to the bottom line. None of us did. We never knew squat about the financials.
Well, be that as it may, you still contributed to making the paper a profitable entity.
That's a hell of an accusation. Can you back it up?
Hey, Matt, I'm not the enemy. I'm just trying to help you build your resume.
Why?
Why?
I mean, it's not like we're gonna just get jobs at a similar company. I mean, no one's hiring reporters.
I didn't tell them a thing about how to write this. I wanted to just let them depict things as they saw it after they talked to a lot of my colleagues. So it's imperfect.
What do you think the playwrights got most wrong about reporters?
The play makes it look like we're always very excited. And, you know, a lot of it's boring. The tedium of journalism, the serious digging, ding, ding, that there's really not much in there. It does kind of look like a big party.
There's generally two ways that journalists are depicted. They're either crusaders who go about uncovering wrongdoing everywhere, sometimes at personal risk, or else they're venal, ambitious climbers that don't care who they destroy on their way to a bigger story, a bigger name, and a bigger paycheck. This play doesn't seem to fall in either of those camps.
No, and certainly there are reporters who fit into those camps, but and you and I both know who they are. But some of the playwrights did sort of want to head towards the dramatic, heroic stuff. And I kept telling Paul that I didn't want this to be, you know, Russell Crowe, whatever that movie is.
State of Play.
Yeah, destroying everything around him to get to the story. Hardly anybody does that. Most of us are not willing to sacrifice our health insurance benefits for a story. And I also didn't want it to be the reverse, which I really get tired of with Hollywood, constantly portraying the press as a bunch of jackals baying at people as they walk down the street. Most of us are just like any collection of people. We're governed by our own insecurities and our desires to do something good and important, but very imperfect. And so I really wanted this to be about how something very imperfect, like a newspaper, can still provide a big social benefit to a community.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Tom Paulson is a former science reporter at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and co-producer of It's Not in the PI, a living newspaper about a dying newspaper. The play ends its initial run this weekend, but the producers are planning a second staging sometime soon.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Fuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and P.J. Vogt, with more help from James Hover and Dan Mazzi, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Hey, Bob, why don't you just stay home next week and nurse that cold?
What cold?
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
In a land where TV audience is shrinking, where virtually all content is available online for free, where media organizations are on the brink of destruction, one man seeks answers amid the chaos. Join Bob Garfield, host of NPR's On the Media, in WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space, Tuesday, December 8th, for The Chaos Scenario. A prophetic look at what the media must do to survive the not-too-distant future. Tickets and information are available at wnyc.org/thegreenspace.